Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Roland Clark, and I'm here today on the New Books Network talking to Emil Sagal, who's a research fellow at Lund University. He's a specialist on Byzantine and Slavic church history, as well as on law and religion, and he's also published a book on the Nordic Orthodox churches. Emil, this is a book about politics in contemporary Montenegro, which gained independence in 2006. But Montenegro has a longer history that's quite important to understanding your book. Can you talk us through briefly who the various rulers of this land, this territory, have been since the Middle Ages?
Yes, of course I can. And thank you for inviting me on to this, Roland. I look forward to talking about this particularly interesting topic. So I will do it very briefly when it comes to the history of Montenegro. There were different attempts to create a sort of political entity in what we nowadays call Montenegro throughout the early Middle Ages. None of them were very long, very successive. But when we come to the end of the Middle Ages, there is one duke, and normally in English we would call him Ivan the Black, Ivan Krondevice, who succeeds in not creating a strong state, but he creates at least a city in the mountain called Sefinice. And that will becomes home to a monastery, for the local Orthodox metropolitan of Montenegro. And I think that creation, sort of the end of the Middle Ages, the beginning of the early modern period, is quite significant because Cetinje become the center of what is nowadays Montenegro. And after Ivan, his son tries to rule, but they're kind of, you know, one of them leaves to Venice, another one becomes Islamized, and rule as a sort of puppet ruler for the Ottomans. But this city of Cetinje and the metropolitan of Montenegro slowly begins to assume political powers. So we see in the 17th century, roughly, that these metropolitans, they are kind of moving from being only church leaders to also being, as the Montenegrins called them, vladikas, which means that they both have the political power over all the tribes, the clans of old Montenegro, but also being church leaders. And that creates sort of what is really interesting, that Montenegro in the early modern period is a theocratic state. It's an Orthodox theocratic state nestled within the Montenegrin mountains. And this theocratic state, monastic leaders in the Orthodox traditions are not married, so they don't have sons. So it's not like a succession of rulers from the same very close family, but it's a succession of rulers from within one clan. And that clan is known as the Petrovicenigos clan, coming closely from Cetinje. So we have a line of rulers from the Petrovicenigos dynasty for almost 300 years that are theocratic rulers. And I think that is a really a key to understand why Montenegro is a special place to study, you know, church-state relation, because it was one of the few theocratic states in Europe. And as we approach modern-day time, some of these theocratic rulers are perhaps not so happy not being married. So one of them, Danilo II, he decides that he wants to get a wife, he wants to become a secular prince. And after that, we slowly see the emergence of Montenegro as a more standardized nation state, we could say, with a ruler, a king of its own. And that is sort of a modern day Montenegro that emerged here by the end of the 19th century. And Montenegro is then recognized as a nation state after the Berlin Conference in 1878. And then we see the birth of a Montenegrin kingdom, actually, that then succumbed in the First World War. So Montenegro actually has a long state history from the Middle Ages to the First World War, and we see a very close relation between church and state in that period. Yeah, I think I will stop there, because when we move beyond the First World War, we then see, you know, different forms of Yugoslavia. But it's just to highlight that the beginning of my book really points to the sense that Montenegro has a long history of statehood, but also has a long history of intersection between religion and politics.
So after the First World War, it becomes part of Yugoslavia. But these days, there's two different Orthodox churches competing for attention in Montenegro. There's the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin Orthodox Church. Do they represent different parts of the population, or who are they representing?
Well, today I would say they represent two different parts of the population. And I suppose, say, the split between this Serbian or pro-Serbian form of Orthodoxy and this pro-Montenegrin form of Orthodoxy actually goes back to the theocratic state. Because these theocratic rulers for almost 300 years, they existed in a gray area between the other Serbian Orthodox and then the Russian Orthodox Church. So by the end of the First World War, when Yugoslavia was created, the Belgrade Patriarchate, what we now call the Serbian Orthodox Church, was also really revived. And it took control over the Montenegrin territory. But there were some in Montenegro who was opposed to this kind of takeover. So already in shortly after the First World War, there is a brief civil war in Montenegro between what is known as the pro-Montenegrins and the pro-Serbians in the Montenegrin mountains. So there has been, from the beginning of the 20th century, this split between pro-Montenegrins and pro-Serbians. And this is actually when we come to the 1990s, and today we see this split being revived and actually forming Montenegrin politics. And that has a mirror within the church split. So we have this so-called Montenegrin Orthodox Church, who are mostly active, supported amongst Montenegrin nationalists. And then we have the pro-Serbian Orthodox Church, or Serbian Orthodox Church in Montenegro, who is mostly supported by Serbian nationalists in Montenegro. So it mirrors the political game between these pro-Serbs and pro-Montenegrins. However, I would say within the last few years, we have seen that the so-called Serbian Orthodox Church had a larger base within Montenegrin society and actually has been able to not revive, but mobilize, I would say, mobilize large part of the Montenegrin society in support of itself. So even though it's mostly supported by Serbian nationalists, we also see that it has a larger base of people who supports it. So the split between this Montenegrin and Serbian church is also, it has its political and its historical reasons.
One of the things I really enjoyed about this book, though, was that you go into the history and the politics, but you also unpack the theology behind the ways that the different Orthodox churches relate to the state. In particular, you talk about Eusebian and Athanasian historiographies. Can you tell us what the difference between the Eusebian and Athanasian ways of thinking about church history are?
Yeah, of course. For me, it all started when I read a paper by a British theologian, and he pointed to, if you look through Russian theology in the 20th century, you will see there is often a division between what we can call imperial or state-centered forms of theologies, and then perhaps more monastic or desert-based form of theology. And we often see that when we talk about ecclesiology, which means how do you understand the church? And then I start wondering, do we also see it in the way people are perceiving the state, in the way they are perceiving history? And that is when we come back to this split between Eusebian and Athanasian. And I would say it's perhaps best understood as a form of ideology or a pattern of thinking. It is not a sort of a very systematic form of theology, but it is some traces we can see throughout history. And the Eusebian one has his name from Eusebius of Caesarea, who was a bishop in the 4th century, and wrote a few very influential books in which he praised the emperor, Constantine the Great, as being the mirror of Christ. So in a way, the emperor and Christ are mirrors of each other, where Christ, of course, being the heavenly king, and then the emperor being the earth king. And I think many have heard this idea before, but Eusebius was really one of the first voices that brought this ideology or this idea of the political as a mirror of the heavenly into Christianity. So these Eusebian lines of thinking then continued throughout the Byzantine Eastern Roman history. And then it was also transferred into, you know, the Eastern Slavic principalities, Kievan Rus, the Bulgarians, and the Serbs. So it is a way of thinking the state and the political entity together. I often say to my students, when you go throughout Eastern Europe, you often see this two-headed eagle, the double-headed eagle, and the two heads of the eagle represent the church and the emperor. And in a sense, that is really, for me, the image of what Eusebian lines of thinking is, that day it's a body that moves towards the same goal, the realization of God's kingdom on earth, but it has two heads, the state and the church. And in contrast to that, we have the Athanasian. So the Athanasian goes back to Athanasius the Great, who was a theologian also in the 4th century, but unlike Eusebius, he wasn't very keen on church powers. He's also often called Athanasius contra mundi, meaning Athanasius against the world, because he was sent in exile 5 times through his lifetime by different emperors. It shows something about he was a very conflictual figure. He was often kind of controversial. And he was often in conflict with various emperors. And for that reason, of course, he wasn't very keen on imperial power. And in one of his, I think, most famous texts where he writes about the monastic, early creation of monasticism, he writes that, you know, the church only have one loyalty and only have one direction, and that is towards God, towards heaven. So its ideal line of thinking is only towards heaven in a sort of a vertical line of influence, one could say. And then Athanasius argues there exists a different form of power, which is earthly power, that exists in a vertical landscape. That is power between humans, between men. And those two things, you know, the vertical and the horizontal kind of powers should not be mixed. So the church is a church, but it is also the wandering through the world and shouldn't be bound to political powers. So the Athanasian lines of thinking is a way to try to perceive the church as something different from the state, as something in contrast to the state, as something that only relates towards God and to the divine and to eternity, while the empire and the political realm is, you know, a timely construction mankind has made in this fallen world, I would say. So the Eusebium is really, you know, the integration between church and politics, while the Athanasian is a way to think the church and theology beyond the state.
And you argue that Montenegrin Orthodox Church draws heavily on the Eusebian model when it talks about the past church history. Why does Eusebius work well for the Montenegrin Orthodox Church?
Eusebius always works well in a national context, I would say. There is a very good quote from one of the Montenegrin nationalists. He says, there is this holy trinity, the trinity between state, nation, and church. And for me, that is just, you know, the best, I would say, formulation of what Eusebian thinking actually means. I would say throughout the 19th and 20th and 21st century, we see this creation of Orthodox nation states, Romania, Serbia, Bulgaria, and so on. And when there is a creation of a nation state, we often see the revival of Eusebian thinking, which means this close collaborations or close interaction between church and state. So the Eusebian lines of arguments fits very well in when you are creating a state or creating a statehood. So in the Montenegrin example throughout the 1990s and today, when we have the sort of recreation of a Montenegrin nation state, it's like the Montenegrin Orthodox Church seeks for ways to argue for its own existence. And because of that, it then, you know, draws in these Eusebian lines of thinking, these Eusebian arguments, and claim, well, we have an independent nation, therefore we also need an independent church. So it fits very well into the pattern of thinking and the context and political reality they are in.
What about the Serbian Orthodox Church? You say that they prefer the approach of Athanasius. Why is that?
I think that the Serbian Orthodox Church is when we talk about it as one coherent unit, it is a bit, it's not completely true. The Serbian Orthodox Church has many points of view and many forms of theology. And in the book, I'm only analyzing a sort of a special trend, I would say, within the Serbian Orthodox Church. And you can, of course, find Eusebian thinking within the Serbian Orthodox Church. They are also kind of promoting the Serbian nation state. But what is interesting in the Montenegrin example is that because the Montenegrins are creating this Montenegrin nation state, the Serbian Orthodox Church in Montenegro has to think beyond the state. It has then to revive itself and point to what kind of reason does it actually have to exist? What is its primary goal? And then the very skilled metropolitan of Montenegro, the Serbian metropolitan of Montenegro, Amfilo Radovic, he draws on his teachers, I would say, which are two very well-known Serbian Orthodox theologians, Popovic and Velimirovic. And all these three Serbs, or Montenegrin Serbs, whatever we like to call them, they have an idea that the church exists beyond the state, that the church is something larger than the state. And they have this vision or idea that the church served this higher purpose, this higher goal. And this church, in fact, should be, you know, encompassing the state. The state should wither away, or the state political structures should be, you know, it is only a timely construction in nowadays, but at one point we will, you know, reach kingdom of God, we will reach God himself beyond the state. So they are trying to think the church and theology not in contrast to the state, but something that is larger than the state. state. So in many ways, when you go through Montenegro, you'll see the construction of new pilgrim sites, churches, various forms of very physical buildings. And most of these points to the idea that there are these sacred spaces in Montenegro and Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, and they all point to this idea that there is something larger than the state. You can participate in God's being. And that is a very sophisticated form of theology. In a sense, it's pointing to something that is eternal, something that is beyond the state.
I think that what you said at the beginning to that answer is really important, that when we talk about churches, we're not talking about a single voice here. There are huge groups of people, and they all disagree with each other. But what we're hearing is sort of a trend. One of the main historical figures cherished by the Serbian Orthodox Church is St. Sava. And it's the theologian Nikolai Velimirovic who revives his cult in the early 20th century. And then specific individuals, his disciples really, have, and protégés, they've taken this cult of St. Sava and promoted it ever since. What does St. Sava represent for Velimirovic and his disciples?
Yeah, it's a very crucial point in Serbian Orthodox theology, which is often, I think, misinterpreted. You often hear this idea there exists a sort of ideology of Sankt Savaism. And then people often quote Velimirovic as an idea of this Sankt Savaism as a sort of political, nationalist, chauvinistic kind of religious ideology. So there exists a whole bulk of literature arguing for that kind of point of view. But I think most Serbian theologians, and me as well, not counting me as a Serb, but as a theologian, would disagree with that. Because if you read Velimirovic's perception of Sankt Sava, it is more the idea again that the church is larger than the state. And Sankt Sava is an image for that. He is the image, he is the perfect image of one person who brings the church to the Serbs, and then he crowned the Serbian king. And they use Sankt Sava and the hagiography of Sankt Sava as a way to retell what role, what function the church has in the modern day society, that the church is something larger than the state, and Sankt Sava becomes an image of that. So when Sankt Sava crowned his brother Stefan, the first crowned king of the Serbs, it is an image that the church is bigger than the state, that the church is actually what crowns the state. And Sankt Sava becomes this very strong image for that. So the revival of Sankt Savaism is more like pointing to the idea that the people is always led by its shepherds. And the main shepherd, the first shepherd of the Serbs, is of course Sankt Sava. So he becomes this sort of Serbian apostle, one could say, and an image and an idea that if you follow Sankt Sava, you are following Christ himself. And this also goes into a core of Serbian Orthodox theology, and that is the idea that one person, a saint, can sort of be a path finder for an entire people. So Sankt Sava himself embodies salvation, and then he is actually a path that the Serbs as a people then can follow. And this is, of course, it has a political implication for the nation as such, but it is a very sophisticated form of theology. So the veneration of Sankt Sava that goes through both Velimirovic and his students point more to the idea that there is something, again, beyond the state, this Athanasian idea, the church is bigger than the state. The church is pointing to the eternity, and Sankt Sava is sort of the pathfinder to eternity.
And Saint Sava, he's really clearly a Serbian saint, and so the Montenegrin church doesn't have much to do with him. But one of the saints which both the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin Orthodox Church fight about is Prince Saint Jovan Vladimir. What's different about the ways the Serbian and Montenegrin churches appropriate Saint Vladimir?
Yeah, the funny thing with Vladimir is he is appropriated by, I think, 8 or 10 different national churches. But in the book, I only discuss the Serbs and the Montenegrins. And I have another book coming up on Jovan Vladimir, so we might return to him one day. But when we go to him, here is Jovan Vladimir. He lived in the 9th and 10th century. And today is sort of when he has been revived in Montenegro. He's a very good example of that the Serbs are trying to take him in as a religious figure, similar to Sankt Sava, as this pathfinder person, as this sacred symbol of the nation. So they are trying to appropriate him as a Serbian Orthodox saint. So they built shrines to him, and they have built a massive cathedral in Bar, well, it's the coastal city of Montenegro. And they have revived sort of pilgrimages and parades devoted to him in order to sort of physically mark their control of his cult. And Ivan Vladimir is then interpreted into the same scheme as Samsara, as one of these pathfinders towards eternity. And of course, that is the strictly religious form, but it also has its political side, because claiming Ivan Vladimir as a certain figure underscores that the Montenegrins has no narrative statehood, because Ivan Vladimir was one of the first sort of indigenous or Slavic-speaking rulers in the area of Montenegro. So the Serbian claim, the Serbian Orthodox claim, has both this religious side, pointing to the embodiment of salvation in Ivan Vladimir, but also this political side. And when it comes to the Montenegrin, Ivan Vladimir is more like, you know, one of the first locally saints. So they use him very simple as a sort of Eusebian argument that we have an old saint in Montenegro, Ivan Vladimir, and he embodied both a church and a state, and he was in an independent ruler, and therefore Montenegro was independent in the 9th-10th century, and it needs to be independent today. So for the Montenegrins, Ivan Vladimir becomes more an argument that the Montenegrins has always been an independent political and religious entity, and I continue to be so even today. So when they're celebrating him, they are sort of more or less celebrating their own kind of independence and just try to project that back in history.
So another, the book you deal with quite a few different saints, but another one of the really important ones is Petar Petrovich Njegoš II, whose tomb has been the site of quite a bitter conflict between the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin government. What's the problem with Njegoš's tomb?
There are many problems with Njegoš's tomb. And Njegoš, he's one of those, you know, belongs to the Petrovich Njegoš dynasty, one of these theocratic rulers. And what is really interesting in him, in his literature, is that he was always a bit ambiguous of what kind of identity he had, if he were Montenegrin or Serbian. So he has this openness for interpretation. And that is what is crucial to understand with the tomb of Njegoš, that his openness to interpretation also means that, just like Ivan Vladimir, the Serbs and the Montenegrins both lay claims to him. And his tomb has also been, it has been reconstructed 4 or 5 times in the past century. So every time a new regime or a new government or a new state comes in control of Montenegro, they are reconstructing his shrine. And that is because his tomb is on the top of Mount Lopšin. Mount Lopšin is the name giver to the Montenegro. It is the Black Mountain. So it's a very symbolic place. And he chose himself to be buried there because he knew that symbolism Lopšin had. The mountain is even, you know, mentioned in the Montenegrin national anthem. So it is really a strong symbol of Montenegrin statehood. And every time, you know, a new dynasty, a new regime comes in place, then it reconstructs the monument on Mount Lopšin. And the last time it was reconstructed was in the 1970, where this huge kind of Art Nouveau mausoleum was constructed by the communists. And they tried to remove sort of religion away from the mountain and then turn Peter II into a secularized figure, a sort of a prophet of liberty, a prophet of independence. So they made this mausoleum that had no religious reference. And of course, today the Montenegrin state really tries to, you know, continue that trail. And when Montenegro became independent, he became a symbol of Montenegrin independence, Montenegrin liberty, and they tried to interpret him and his tomb as a sort of a symbolic construction of Montenegrin independence. And that is really in contrast to the Serbian Orthodox Church, who claim him as a religious leader, because he was this vladika. He was both one with secular powers, and he was also a metropolitan. So the Serbian Orthodox Church, they tried to claim him as a religious symbol and tried to claim him as a Serbian Orthodox symbol. And the really sort of the conflict then between the church and the state in Montenegro, the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin state, was during the Jubilee for his birth, or his 200 years jubilee, I think, was really about what kind of monument, what kind of celebrations should we have at Njegoš? Should it be a religious one, Serbian Orthodox one, that celebrates, you know, Orthodoxy and Serbia, or should it be a more secularized Montenegrin one? So kind of the interesting thing is, in the fight over him, you see again the political and religious sides being mirrored. So they're fighting over this mausoleum, but in many ways they're fighting over the symbols of Montenegro, and also, you know, the interpretation of what Montenegro is.
So this sort of methodology that you're using of, let's understand present day conflicts, particularly between church and state, by looking at the way that these churches talk about medieval saints or the way they appropriate history, do you think that can be applied to other contexts? So, for example, outside Montenegro, if we went to the conflict in North Macedonia between the Archbishop of Ohrid and the Serbian Orthodox Church, can you use the same methodology there?
Yeah, my initial idea was to try to develop this kind of methodology. It can be used more places. I'm not quite sure if I did it perfectly well, but at least I think I made some traces or again line of thinking that could be used elsewhere. And that is because we see throughout Eastern Europe after the communist period, a lot of, you know, debates and discussion about memories, about sites, about sacred sites, and about what role the church should play. And they all have sort of similar patterns. So I tried to develop this framework, this idea of nationalization of the sacred, which is also the title of the book, that in many ways the churches, but also the states, are trying to turn these sacred sites or the sacred histories. And that is why we talk so much about saints, because they are both, you know, embodying history, but also memory, but also physical places like the Mount Lovchen, but also, you know, churches in general. So when we look at North Macedonia, Bulgaria, Romania, we often see that whenever they discuss history, they're also discussing the church, and they're also discussing these sacred places. And that, of course, takes place in Macedonia as well. There is a long history in Macedonia for discussing Macedonian statehood. Macedonian statehood is, like elsewhere, closely related to the church. However, the interesting thing is, while I was, you know, finishing up this book, we saw kind of an interesting development in North Macedonia. And that was that the North Macedonian Orthodox Church, as they call themselves, who have been in a schism with the Serbian Orthodox Church since 1968, they suddenly made an agreement with the Serbian Orthodox Church and found a compromise. So they are now welcomed into the Orthodox family. But they're remaining there. They are retaining their name. But the struggles up until 2022 between the Serbs and the Macedonian was also over, you know, the religious history.
What's their conflict in terms of religious history?
Well, it all comes down to the Archbishop of Ohrid. But the interesting thing is, you know, in Montenegro, the fight was between Montenegrins and Serbs. It was just two poles fighting over, you know, history. The Archbishop of Ohrid is a much more complex history. The Greeks lay claim to the Archbishop of Ohrid. The Albanians also lay some claims to the Archbishop of Ohrid. The Bulgarians lay a strong claim to the Archbishop of Ohrid. And we just talked about Velimirovic, the Serbian bishop. He was actually Serbian bishop of Ohrid during the period, the pre-war period between the First World War and Second World War. He was the Serbian bishop of Ohrid. So there are many who lays claims to the history of Ohrid. Not only just, it's not just a fight between Macedonian and Serbs, but between Macedonians and almost every country that is neighbor to Macedonia. So in that sense, the conflict is much more multifaceted than the one we see in Montenegro.
Yeah, it's terrible having a place that's too popular.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah.
What about the conflict in Ukraine between the Patriarchate of Kiev and the autonomous Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate? Is that conflict also a conflict over who owns the past?
Yeah, for sure it is. And there are so many parallels between Ukraine and Montenegro and Serbia. In both places, you have sort of the same political development, that you have this multi-ethnic national federation, the Soviets, but also Yugoslavia, that is then fragmented, and then new nation states arrives, Montenegro and Ukraine. So they're kind of, you know, in a sense, breakaway from the old socialist federations. And in these new breakaway, we see the revival of a local Orthodox tradition then fighting against the old kind of federational forms of churches. So this fight between the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin are mirroring the fight between the Moscow Patriarchate and the new rising Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the independent church after 2018. And that's also, we see so many parallels in the conflict. So the fight over Ivan Vladimir very much looks like the fight over Volodymyr or Vladimir of Kiev. There are the same patterns and the same lines of thinking, and the same arguments are being reused. And we did also see before 2018 that the Kiev Patriarchate under Metropolitan Filaret actually had close relation to the Montenegrin Orthodox Church, because both of them were sort of a schism. So there was this period from the 1990s almost until 2018, where we had a sort of a shadow group of Orthodox churches going both in Ukraine, but also Moldova and Bulgaria, Macedonia and Montenegro. Orthodox churches that was in sort of schism, or at least they were not recognized by the other Orthodox churches, and they supported each other. And two very close supporters was the Ukrainian and the Montenegrins, because there were so many similarities in their situation. So yeah, Ukraine is the big example, where Montenegro is a very small example.
And finally, you mentioned a minute ago, the title of the book is The Nationalization of the Sacred, which is a key term for your methodology. Can you tell us what you mean by the nationalization of the sacred?
Yeah, for me, the nationalization of the sacred is sort of a process in which we see sacred places, sacred ideas, theology mainly, but also sacred materials, so the saint, but also, you know, the saint's body or the saint's crown, or, you know, materials closely related to the saint being nationalized. So as most of you probably know, the idea is Christianity is a universal religion, belongs to everyone. What we see in many of these example in Eastern Europe, that this idea of universality, that the sacred is universal, is being delimited into national building blocks. So San Sava is, for example, not just a saint for everyone, he's a saint for the Serbs. So, and I call that the nationalization process. And it's closely related to the creation of nation states. So once we see nation states emerge, we also see a process of nationalization of sacred materials, sacred sites, and sacred things. So that is basically my point of departure, or at least the sort of idea behind it, and using to line up, or at least follow the arguments throughout history. So what we see in Ukraine, North Macedonia, and Montenegro is these process of nationalization, where you turn the Archbishop of Ohrid not into a church that encompasses many nationality, but only the Macedonians. And where the Kiev Rus idea is not something that encompasses all Northern Slavs, it is just Ukraine. So that is sort of the nationalization process we see here. And it plays closely related to another process we had seen existing in Eastern Europe in the 1990s, and that is called the sacralization of the nation. So those two processes, the nationalization of the sacred and the sacralization of the nations, are working together. The sacralization of the nation is mostly known as a way political elites use religion to legitimize their claim on land or their claim on politics. We see it with Putin's speech, for example, or Milosevic's speeches, that their claim to Kosovo or to Ukraine is being legitimized by using religious language. So they are sacralizing, they're putting a sacred kind of idea into their national politics. But what is different between the nationalization process and the sacralization process is the sacralization process is a political one. It is by political elites. And when you look on most of research that has been done in Eastern Europe, it often focuses on this idea of the sacralization. It is looking closely on the instrumentalization of the church, that the church is being used as an instrument by political elites. But what has often struck me as kind of interesting is that all of these very good analyses, they often miss one point, and that is the church is not just an instrument. The church has an agenda of its own. And I tried with this methodology or this idea of the nationalization to follow the path of the church and what the church thinks. And the church is also doing something, and that is the nationalization. It is also turning the sacred into a national category. And I think that is kind of an interesting idea to follow the church and the church leaders and their ideas, and to see that theology also has a role to play in the way they think about politics, and that the church is an agent in all of these changes we see in Eastern Europe. It is not just a passive instrument. It has an agenda of its own.
Yes, very true. That's about all we have time for today. But thank you so much for sharing this book with us. And there's so much more into it that we didn't get time today. So I recommend that anyone listening go out and buy a copy straight away, so you can get more details on what you've just heard.
Thanks so much for inviting me on. And I think actually the book will be out in open access, so it's free to access.
You don't even have to buy it.
You don't have to buy it. Just read it.
Excellent. Thanks, Emil.